evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, November 18th, 2019. A fuel tanker explosion kills at least three in South Sudan.
When it started, it took a few minutes before fire started inside of it. The fire then went and caught petrol truck to which fuel was being pumped into from the other truck that overturned.
And a big donation from the U.S. to an aid agency operating in South Sudan.
This $92.5 million in funding is helping a USAID partner, World Food Program, not only respond to the urgent needs in flood-affected areas, but for the lean season and for pre-positioning in 2020.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. At least three, possibly four people were killed and six others injured yesterday after a fuel tanker that overturned exploded in Maridi State. One of the injured says he and others were trying to pump petrol from the tanker to another truck using a generator when it exploded. Lasuba Memo has more for VOA from Juba.
22-year-old mechanic Thomas Taban, a resident of Maridi Town, says he and his assistant were hired to repair a generator which was being used to pump fuel from the overturned tanker to another truck. He says the generator short-circuited shortly after they tried to fix it.
When it started, it took a few minutes before fire started inside of it. The fire then went and caught petrol truck to which fuel was being pumped into from the other truck that overturned. The blaze first went past my head and I fell down before it came back to where it started from. So when I tried to pull from down, the fire caught my legs and my hands.
Taban says his assistant was killed in the incident. He says when the generator exploded, he quickly dug his legs and hands into soil to put out the fire on his body, then fled the scene. Maridi State Information Minister Peter Saki says the explosion occurred in Mambe County, 16 miles from Maridi Town. He says two of the deceased were Somali truck drivers who died at Maridi Civil Hospital last night, and a Sudanese national from Darfur died this morning.
There was, of course, 10 people around in that area which are affected.
There were 10 people around the area affected, the owners of the two trucks, and then the two gentlemen who left from Maridi Town here with the generator, the assistant of the man who owns the generator plus a Somali driver. Two of them passed away. Today around 7:45 in the morning, the other Somali who went from Maridi Town to help his colleague also lost his life.
Saki says three of the six admitted to Maridi Civil Hospital were transferred to Juba Teaching Hospital. Martin Adil Saverino, a medical doctor at the Maridi Hospital, says medical staff at the hospital treated 10 victims from Sunday's tanker fire. He confirms four of them died from what he describes as major burns.
Four of them are major burns.
Four of them had major burns and the condition was so bad. According to the guideline on managing of major burns, the percentage of the burns was very big. In these critical cases, the percentage of the burns were more than 70%, meaning they had little chance to survive. We found myoglobinuria, which is a serious indicator of someone having a lower chance.
In September 2015, more than 200 people died when a fuel tanker exploded near Maridi Town. At the time, local leaders said villagers tried to siphon fuel from the overturned tanker when it exploded into a ball of fire, killing most of the bystanders. It was described as the deadliest accident of its kind in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
After the 100-day extension to form a unity government in South Sudan was announced by the parties to the revitalized peace deal, a bipartisan group of six U.S. senators wrote a letter on Wednesday to U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They asked him to appoint a high-level special envoy to South Sudan to, quote, engage the region and help coordinate Western partners in pressing both parties to forge a viable path forward over the next 3 months and beyond, end quote. It said the senators support the U.S. Treasury Department's move to sanction South Sudanese elites and corrupt government officials that have profited from the conflict. The senators said the envoy should also implement a robust diplomatic strategy with like-minded international partners to prevent renewed violence and encourage a sustainable political settlement. Yeah. The United States government has donated $92.5 million to provide humanitarian assistance to hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese affected by the conflict, food insecurity, and recent flooding, which has affected more than 900,000 people. One analyst in Juba says the donation is one way that the Trump administration is using to highlight the government's inability or unwillingness to alleviate the suffering of its people. Demo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Tina Yu, the USAID team leader in South Sudan, says this latest donation will help the UN World Food Program to provide more emergency food and nutrition assistance to vulnerable South Sudanese.
This $92.5 million in funding is helping a USAID partner, World Food Program, not only respond to the urgent needs in flood-affected areas, but for the lean season and for pre-positioning in 2020. Of the 32 counties, flood-affected counties, 24 of those, which is about 40%, are experiencing food insecurity during the lean season.
You say it's more than 60% of flood-affected areas face extreme levels of acute malnutrition and food insecurity even before the flooding. More than 7 million South Sudanese need humanitarian assistance, according to the latest Integrated Pest Classification Report. As of the beginning of this month, WFP says it had reached 400,000 of the more than 750,000 people in urgent need of food aid in flood-affected areas of Jonglei, Upper Nile, Unity, and the Bahr Ghazal regions. EU says the United States is the single largest donor of humanitarian assistance to South Sudan, reaching more than 1.3 million people in South Sudan with life-saving humanitarian assistance every month.
They are responding in terms of food assistance, nutrition, life-saving medical assistance, emergency shelter, safe drinking water, and protection for vulnerable communities affected by these floods.
Last week, the Trump administration announced it is re-evaluating its relations with South Sudan after President Salva Kiir and SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar failed to form a unity government by the November 12th deadline. The two agreed to extend the pre-transitional period for another 100 days. Abraham Kuol, assistant professor of politics, peace and security studies at the University of Juba, says the U.S. donation will do the things the Kiir administration is supposed to be doing for its citizens.
And in this case, when the U.S. government is saying that they are going to review the relationship, the relation with the government of Juba or government of South Sudan, it means that they are going to use their funding power, their funding ability, to be able to give government pressure, to be able to get into the demand of trying to compromise their position of which they had been handling, which they had been highlighting.
Kuol says through this latest donation, the U.S. is highlighting the fact that South Sudanese leaders are failing to end the suffering of their people.
They should be able to look at ease. They will be able to see, say that, look here, as the government, the people of South Sudan are only knowing that their life is depending on the donation from the international community. And if you are not listening to our voice, then there is possibility of the U.S. government, through the civil society organization, create a long and serious activism among the people of South Sudan population.
And Kuol says that activism may turn the people against the government. To prevent that from happening, Kuol says the Kiir administration should respond to the needs of the people during emergencies rather than letting other governments step in and do the work. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
An organization that assesses global risks has ranked four African countries as the most dangerous in the world, including South Sudan. International SOS put together an interactive map that assesses risks based on medical, security, and road safety. Libya, Somalia, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan were ranked in the lowest safety band in all three categories: very high for travel medical risk, extreme extreme for travel security risk and more than 25 deaths per 100,000 deaths for road safety risk. Other countries graded extreme for security risk include Mali, along with Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Afghanistan, Eritrea, Burkina Faso, Niger, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea-Bissau, and Burundi all scored very high for travel medical risk in Africa. Human Rights Watch says attacks by some Sudanese security forces on protesters in early June were planned and therefore could amount to crimes against humanity. In a report released today, HRW is calling on Sudan's transitional authorities to arrest security forces who attacked protesters with deadly force since December. As Michael Atit from Khartoum reports for VOA, credible sources said more than 100 people were killed in those attacks.
The 59-page report documents how Sudanese security forces in Khartoum attacked protesters during the massive sit-in on June 3rd and in the days that followed in other neighborhoods of the capital as well as the neighborhood of Bahri and Omdurman. Jehan Henry, Associate Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, says her organization documented several attacks on protesters leading up to the June 3rd crackdown and the subsequent attack on protesters on June 30th in Omdurman.
They shot unarmed protesters and killed them on the spot. They also rounded up protesters and beat them, cut their hair, insulted them, and held them arbitrarily in detention for periods of time before releasing them. We also documented many cases of rape and other sexual assaults.
The report says credible sources estimated that at least 120 people were killed on June 3rd and following days. Hundreds were injured and dozens more missing. Henry says the Human Rights Watch team also confirmed that some bodies of the protesters were retrieved from the River Nile, who were executed and thrown into the river. She says many Sudanese families told a Human Rights Watch team that their loved ones are still missing. She says many people are calling for a transparent investigation and want the perpetrators held accountable, including those who might be holding high position in the transitional government.
The crimes that were committed in this context could be crimes against humanity because it appears that they were planned in advance and they're part of a systematic attack on protesters that Sudanese security forces have carried out since December. The method of cracking down on protesters has included live ammunition, so shooting to kill, shooting dead the protesters.
Henry says Sudan's transitional government should ensure that all investigations are independent, transparent, and conform to international standards. She suggests that the new investigation committee formed last September by Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok could seek assistance from experts with the African Union, the United Nations, or the recognized entities. Henry says the government should also reform controversial laws such as the National Security Act and the Public Order Act, which violate human rights.
We would like to see the government take some initial steps to ratify key human rights treaties such as the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women.
Nationwide protests started outside Khartoum in mid-December 2018, triggered by the price increase. These quickly evolved into protests against Sudan's president of 30 years, Omar al-Bashir, and his administration. Repeated calls to the head of the recently appointed investigation committee, Nabil Adib, and the spokesperson for the Sovereign Council, Muhammad al-Faqih, for comment on this story went unanswered. For VOA News, I am Michael Atid in Khartoum.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Major food shortages in Cameroon could spread to its northern neighbors. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the biggest problem facing your country's leaders?
Their lack of commitment, you know, commitment in the sense to solving or addressing the issues affecting the country's development. So, you know, if they are committed, they will be able to solve, to identify certain problems and solve those problems appropriately.
I think the very first is policy somersault and the lack of vision.
Leaders do not have programs for the country. Leaders, they don't put country as a priority. So that's why leaders are not willing to help or to come up with the programs that can at least put resources in the hands of the citizens.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Cameroonian authorities say they fear a severe food shortage may hit the Central African nation's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Violent floods that began weeks ago have swept away farms and grazing lands for cattle and killed at least 7 people in recent days. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Gobo in northern Cameroon, many people are fleeing to Chad to escape the floodwaters.
Floodwaters sweep through Gobo on Cameroon's northern border with Chad, swamping farmlands, ranches, schools, roads and markets. The weeks of flooding have raised fears that a severe food shortage may grip the area if waters fail to recede, preventing farmers from returning to plant crops. Gobo-based government agriculture advisor Dennis Ngouimba says the damage is extensive.
Sur l'ensemble des trois régions, des millions d'hectares sont déjà.
He says the situation is very damaging to agricultural production as millions of hectares of land can no longer be cultivated. He says the consequences are potentially damaging to the area that has farming and cattle ranching as the main economic activities. A majority of the 80,000 people of Gobo are farmers and cattle ranchers. 42-year-old farmer Ahmad Sendi says floods destroyed food stocks in their warehouse. He says he and his workers have been able to cultivate only 20% of their farms since August. Sendi says Burun is one of the villages that grows the highest quantity of cotton in northern Cameroon, but that the devastating floods have not allowed him as well as other farmers to go to their farms within the past 3 months. He says rice and groundnut farms are completely flooded and their cattle are dying. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Midjiyawa Bakari, says authorities are already thinking of how to help flood victims return to their farms as soon as possible.
Vous savez très bien que du fait de la nébuleuse Boko Haram.
He says while waiting for the flooding to end, there are plans to bring food stocks that could not be exported to neighboring countries and southern markets due to Boko Haram terrorism to the affected people who are already hungry. Boko Haram militant attacks over the past 6 years have led many farmers to abandon lands in Cameroon's far north region. Seasonal flooding has only added to the misery of those remaining. 40-year-old school teacher Shadak Abraham says floodwaters on Friday destroyed 3 classrooms in Gobo.
La majorité des élèves ne viennent plus à l'établissement.
He says both teachers and children fled the school after being inundated by floodwaters that killed a teacher and 3 children he was trying to save from the current. The floods also killed 3 other people in the area, says Sadak, and have been submerging them for the past 3 weeks. Sadat said it was not possible to know the exact number of children who died because many parents tried to take them to safety. The United Nations says 40,000 people have been directly affected by weeks of flooding in the area. The worst flooding in northern Cameroon claimed 60,000 lives in 2012 when heavy rainfall fell in the area for more than a month. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Gobo, Cameroon.
A United Nations study finds that more than 7 million children worldwide are imprisoned, institutionalized, or detained in immigration centers. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva at the launch of the Global Study on Children Deprived of Liberty.
In more than 700 pages, the study describes the suffering endured by millions of children locked up in prisons, abandoned and institutionalized in orphanages, held in migrant centers or other places of detention. The study says children deprived of liberty are among the most vulnerable, discriminated, and excluded members of society. It says they are victims of abuse, neglect, and exploitation by others. It says thousands of children recruited by terrorist and extremist groups are arrested by authorities and treated as perpetrators instead of as victims. The independent expert leading the study, Manfred Novak, is professor of international human rights law at the University of Vienna. He says depriving children of their liberty is a violation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. He says the detention of children should be a measure of last resort and for the shortest period of time.
In principle, children should not be deprived of liberty, and states should look to find non-custodial solutions. And usually they are available. It's simply a question of politics, whether you invest primarily in the criminal justice system or you invest more in the child welfare system and support the families.
Novak says migration-related detention of children can never be considered as a measure of last resort. He tells VOA the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their parents at the Mexican-U.S. border is absolutely prohibited by the Convention on the Rights of the Child. He considers this inhuman treatment for both the parents and the children.
Children should never be in migration-related detention. So that means that should not be used as an excuse to separate the children from the parents. If there's a decision to deport them to the country of origin, there's always a way that they can stay at a place where they are not deprived of liberty and nevertheless can be deported together.
The study says children deprived of freedom suffer from anxiety and depression. Many have suicidal thoughts and post-traumatic stress. It warns psychiatric disorders for children in detention can increase tenfold during their confinement and often results in early death among children when released. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pope Francis held a special mass and meal for the poor, including migrants, at the Vatican over the weekend. Correspondent Castle Franco reports for VOA from Rome.
Some 150 round tables were prepared in the large Vatican Hall, where the Pope normally holds his indoor audiences with the faithful during the winter months. There he hosted lunch for poor people, including migrants and about 50 volunteers who work with the needy. Before lunch was served, the Pope thanked all those present and asked God to bless them and their families. The menu for all the Pope's guests was lasagne, chicken with cream of mushroom sauce and potatoes, dessert, fruit, and espresso coffee. Elsewhere in Rome, another 1,500 needy people were also served lunch and in many parishes. Earlier on Sunday, the Pope celebrated a special mass in St. Peter's Basilica to raise awareness about the poor in the world. The mass was attended by the poor and the volunteers who later lunched with the Pope. During the service, Pope Francis said, "The poor facilitate our access to heaven," and described them as the treasure of the Church. Francis encouraged the faithful not to feel annoyed when the poor knock on our doors, but to welcome them and help them as much as possible.
Quanti anziani, quanti nascituri.
How many elderly, babies, disabled and poor people are considered useless, the Pope said in his homily, adding that we go our way in haste without worrying that gaps are increasing, that the greed of a few is adding to the poverty of many others. The Pope told the faithful to ask themselves the question, do I help someone who has nothing to give me in return? Do I, as a Christian, have at least one poor person as a friend? The Pope, who chose the name Francis after the saint of the poor, has focused his attention on the world's marginalized since the start of his papacy. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
That's our show for this Monday. We leave you now with a song, Africa Moto, by Moses Sisingo. We've been listening to Moses Sisingo with the song Africa Moto. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Africa,
dante fever.